Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau, of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Some have seen suburban development as the realization of the American dream. Others have condemned it as an environmental disaster. In either case, it's one of the most important developments in recent American history, and a topic we will address this week with Adam Rome, author of The Bulldozer in the Countryside, Suburban Sprawl and the Rise of American Environmentalism. And after that, historian David Elwood draws some lessons from the Allied occupation of Italy during World War II for our current operations in Iraq. But first, Joey Skidmore takes us back to an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on January 24, 1908, the Boy Scout movement began in England with the publication of the first installment of Robert Baden-Powell's Scouting for Boys. Baden-Powell was already well known as a war hero, but in 1899 he wrote a military field manual, Aids to Scouting, for British troops, which became very popular with boys, who enjoyed the lessons on tracking and observation. Baden-Powell decided to try out his ideas by arranging a scouting camp at Brown Sea Island in Dorsetshire, where in 1907, 21 boys from diverse backgrounds and ages spent 2 weeks learning camping, observation, woodcraft, life-saving, and boating, as well as patriotism and chivalry. A scouting uniform was designed, and by the end of 1908, over 60,000 Boy Scouts were registered throughout the British Commonwealth. The American version of the Boy Scouts was organized by Chicago publisher William Boyce, who, as the legend goes, became lost in one of London's pea soup fogs and was led to his destination by a young Boy Scout. Inspired by this noble spirit, Boyce returned to the United States and incorporated the Woodcraft Indians and the Sons of Daniel Boone into the Boy Scouts of America. In 1920, the first International Boy Scout Jamboree was held in London, and Baden-Powell was named Chief Scout.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, the debate over Australia's colonial past has heated up a bit with publication of two books which take opposing sides in the matter. In The Fabrication of Aboriginal History, Volume 1, Van Diemen's Land, 1803-1847, Keith Windschuttle defends the position that British colonization of Australia was justified, that the land was never truly owned by its original inhabitants, and that they were too savage to understand such a concept as property, and too primitive and vulnerable to survive settlement. Robert Mann responded to Windschuttle with a collection of essays titled Whitewash, in which the essayists accuse Windschuttle of, as one author put it, using a system of historical filters to remove any evidence of British and later Australian misdeeds, land lust, violence, and cruelty. And at a recent speech in Fredericksburg, Virginia, presidential historian Michael Beschloss told his audience that they should ask themselves one question when casting their votes for president. Is the candidate someone who would be willing to lose an election by doing an unpopular thing that happens to be the best thing for the country? By way of example, Beschloss cited President John Kennedy, whose push for civil rights not only cost him Southern support, but also his life. Kennedy went to Dallas in 1963, where he was assassinated, Beschloss pointed out, to answer his Southern critics. This is Talking History. The United States experienced an unprecedented move out of the nation's cities to the suburbs after World War II. The movement made available affordable single-family homes to millions of middle-class Americans, but it also changed the American landscape. It's a complex, many-sided story addressed this week by Talking History's Fred Nielsen, professor of history at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and his guest, Adam Rome.
50 years ago, William Levitt was a national hero. By building inexpensive houses in new suburban communities, he and others had helped thousands of families acquire their own homes for the first time. It seemed like the realization of the American dream. But in the words of Stuart Udall at the time, cities had often grown too fast to grow well. It became apparent that these new suburban developments often came with environmental costs in the form of increased energy consumption, pollution, and sprawl. With me to discuss suburbanization and its ecological consequences is Adam Rome, a professor of history at Penn State University, and the author of The Bulldozer in the Countryside, Suburban Sprawl and the Rise of American Environmentalism. Professor Rome, welcome.
Thanks.
The United States experienced a housing revolution after World War II. What exactly was going on?
Well, before then, people mostly built houses one at a time, and many builders wouldn't even build three or four of them in the course of a whole year. And that had always struck observers as an incredibly archaic, unproductive way of going about it, and people had been hoping for mass production to come into the housing industry. And Levitt and others like him around the country pioneered in World War II and then especially afterward mass production techniques, factory in the field kind of techniques for building houses where they could build dozens of them a day, thousands of them a year instead of only a handful. And Levitt himself, people talked about him as akin to Henry Ford, that the Levitt-style house was the Model T of the housing industry and would now allow, for the first time ever, a majority of Americans to become homeowners.
Your book includes some striking aerial photographs of the construction of a California suburb in 1950. I realize this is radio, but I wonder if you could describe what those pictures were all about and why you included them in your book. What should we read into them?
These were pictures that the developers of this town in California, Lakewood, hired someone to make, and ultimately they bound them in a leather volume and they gave them away to all kinds of people. They were very proud of this development that was very much like Levittown. It had 17,000 houses ultimately. And the pictures show in a series of stages the mass production of houses. The first one, the most striking one, I think, is just a bulldozed landscape. There's nothing in it except the tracks of bulldozers, no trees, no topographical variation of any kind, just bare ground. And then the second one shows piles of lumber, dozens and dozens of piles of lumber spaced out where each house would be. And again, that's the only thing you see. And then in the third and the fourth pictures, you see the frame beginning to go up and then finally the frame complete. And you can see, too, that there's only, although there's hundreds of houses visible in the last of these photographs, that there's only two or three different ways that the houses were built, designed. And at first, as I say, the builders and Business Week and various other observers use these photographs to tout this new way, this revolutionary new way of building that was going to bring home ownership to millions and help boom the economy as people were realizing that home ownership would be the key to a new consumer economy. But within about 15 years, the way in which people, some people at least, saw these photographs had completely changed. And instead of being proud of this new way of building, people were looking at it as a wasteland, an incredibly destructive, ecologically destructive way of working on the land. The first time I think that it was used that way was in a kind of anti-coffee table book called God's Own Junkyard that was a diatribe about various environmental catastrophes that Americans had brought on themselves. And by the late 60s, many people were using the same pictures as posters essentially for the cause of environmentalism instead.
You mentioned briefly a moment ago the design of the houses in the suburban developments. Could you be more specific about that? How did the design of houses change after World War II?
One way that turned out to be important that building changed was that, although this had been slowly changing before, homes used to be built differently in different parts of the country. That people realized a house in Minnesota would need to be different than a house in South Carolina. And the differences allowed for adaptations to climate, to the seasons, and they made it easier to keep houses cool in the summer and warm in the winter. This new method of building was uniform everywhere, and it involved a simple slab, usually instead of no basement, one-story houses that were cookie-cutter, little boxes from Malvina Reynolds' song, that you could only choose one or two designs. They had virtually no insulation, and in fact, in a whole bunch of ways, some of the ways that the builders kept the cost down and made the house so supremely affordable for the first time caused incredible environmental problems, greater use of energy, soil erosion, more flooding, effects on wildlife, and so forth.
There's a brief, very brief flirtation with solar houses, but that doesn't seem to last very long.
I was really surprised by that, and in a way that tied to the biggest surprise for me in the whole project, that when I first started looking at this, I'd kind of grown up with a sense that suburbia was wasteful. I was born in 1959 and was a teenager when the environmental movement really got into full swing, and it influenced me greatly. So I'd had this sense that suburbia was wasteful, but I assumed that that was pretty recent, that it didn't date much before 1970. And I found, much to my surprise, that the first criticisms of suburbia from an environmental point of view started way before that, in some cases in the 1940s. And the solar house was one example of that, that people realized right away that this new way of building created houses that were energy sucks, that they were incredibly difficult to keep cool in the summer and to keep warm in the winter. And during World War II, when we were having fuel rationing and people were very conscious of energy conservation, a variety of architects and others began to talk about the possibility of saving energy by solar design and also solar equipment becoming part of housing. And this interest actually attracted lots of people in government and industry and the foundation world in the professions, and lasted for about a decade until the Korean War was over. And although they had other arguments as well beside the energy conserving aspects, people thought that this new solar housing would also bring people closer to nature. It didn't catch on. It was it required building in ways that were more expensive and more difficult, and that the people who could afford to do that were people buying expensive houses, but the people who benefited the most from it were people who were on a budget, and they ended up having essentially to trade off cheap house purchase price for more expensive house to heat and cool and maintain.
Automobiles obviously play an important part in the rise of suburbia, but as you make very clear in your book, so do septic tanks, and the results weren't always pretty.
They can be pretty disgusting, actually. That the cheapest land, and therefore the places that you'd want to put your cheapest houses, was often beyond the range of the sewer systems of cities. And builders respond to that by using a technology that before had been used only mainly on farms, the underground septic tank. And very quickly after World War II, people start noticing that these fail in large numbers, and the failures were really quite vivid. Your basement could fill up with sewage. Lawns could become inundated with sewage. You could see sewage floating down the street in the gutter. One critic in a sarcastic novel even depicts people in a neighborhood mistaking the puddles of sewage for a lake, and they are going to turn it into a swimming pool, and it's disgusting. So people quickly realize that's a threat to their health and their safety. The other thing that really dramatically happens is that after detergents come into widespread use, those people who had septic tanks and also were relying on underground wells for their water supply found that the detergents were polluting the wells through the septic system, and they turn on their faucets and foam comes out in the late 50s, and people start joking about it, kind of black humor, white beer, detergent cocktails, but it wasn't very funny. People were horrified. And this is really, in some ways, the first time that water pollution hits home as an issue for many, many thousands of people, especially suburbanites.
Well, you note that the accumulation of these problems comes to a kind of head in the late 60s and 70s, coinciding with the rise of the environmental movement.
Well, it's really before that, though, because it happens in two ways. Some of these problems are first noticed by experts, people in various professions, public health officials, architects, scientists of various kinds, hydrologists, geologists. But some of them also are visible to the homeowners themselves and to people in communities across the country. And the detergents was one example of that. The other one, it's actually kind of the centerpiece of my book, and gives the book its title, is the growing horror at the destruction of the countryside as bulldozers come to create new subdivisions. And the way in which that was described as an issue and became a rallying cry for grassroots protest was to preserve open space, that people want to save the forests and the little marshes and meadows nearby for their kids to play in for a whole host of reasons. And as they see these kinds of spaces disappearing in this onslaught of a million or more acres a year, grassroots protests arise by the late 50s and into the early 60s, and people begin to use a very recognizably environmentalist rhetoric. They start talking about the rape of the countryside. Saturday Evening Post even had a story where that was the title, The Rape of the Land, and people begin to protest against it in thousands, probably, of local communities. So before 1970, before the first Earth Day, before all the major environmental acts that we now look back on as the cornerstone of the environmental movement, people were already mobilizing both in professional groups and at the grassroots to stop some of these ways of building.
When did they start worrying specifically about suburban sprawl?
That word probably comes into common usage in the United States in the late 50s. There were a series of magazine articles, many of them written by one person. He's really a key leader in the protest against sprawl, William White, who had been an editor at Fortune magazine and had written a famous book about post-war culture called The Organization Man. But he becomes very keenly interested in sprawl and starts publishing in all the magazines that Fortune owns, Fortune, Life, a variety of professional magazines in the late 50s, Architectural Forum. And so people in planning circles and architectural circles are beginning to think about sprawl in the late 50s. And by 1960, it's already a political issue at the national level. John Kennedy promises to do something about it. And he takes one little step. He encourages a program that would allow, with federal funds, local communities to buy land to save as open space. That doesn't really control sprawl, but it at least prevents the bulldozed landscape from spreading totally across the metropolitan scene.
Your book focuses on the suburban aspects of environmentalism and on the rise, as you've been talking about now, of the environmental movement. There seem to be steps, some of them successful at the state, local, and even the national levels. And yet, in the end, I was left with the feeling that, as you conclude, there's a kind of equivocation here, an ambivalence on the part of many Americans. They're environmentalists, but only to a point. I guess my question is this. To what extent have suburban Americans become environmentalists?
I think you're right on, that in some ways they became very keen environmentalists, and part of the message of my book is that suburbanites looking at their surroundings become one of the driving forces of the rising environmental movement. And that leads to a whole series of very important measures. For the first time, people begin to talk about restricting property rights, that it's no longer acceptable in many states and after 1970 to have a landowner do anything they want with their property, or a builder or a developer. And in fact, some people at the time talked about these new land use regulations as a quiet revolution, because they really did challenge this deeply held idea that private property was purely a personal matter. And instead, they argued that, no, it affects the community. It affects people well beyond the borders of the property. So in that way, there is a dramatic sign that the environmental movement has taken hold and that it's begun to challenge the way we develop and build. On the other hand, you know, you just have to look around any metropolitan area today. We haven't solved the problem of sprawl. And although some of the old environmental impacts are no longer as severe from building as they were in the 50s and 60s, many of them still are. And the total amount of land taken by metropolitan development is way more now than it was when sprawl first became an issue. And I think there's lots of reasons for that, but I do end my book with the thought that when people buy houses, they very seldom think about the environment. The things that matter to them when they're trying to decide what a good house is are the taxes, the schools, the kind of rooms, the neighborhood, but they're not thinking about how the house affects the environment, how the construction of the house or living in the house would affect the environment. And I think in that way, this is a big challenge the environmental movement has failed to rise to so far, to get the vast majority of people thinking in their everyday lives as consumers and not just in the workplace or in legislative halls about what it would mean to live in a sustainable way.
Well, Professor Rome, thanks for visiting with us today.
My pleasure.
I've been talking with Adam Rome, the author of The Bulldozer in the Countryside, Suburban Sprawl and the Rise of American Environmentalism.
Commentary of the week, we offer an historical parallel for current U.S. activities in Iraq, namely the Allied occupation of Italy during World War II. Here to explain that parallel is David Elwood. Elwood is a professor of international history at the University of Bologna and the author of Italy 1943-1945, The Politics of Liberation.
When does liberation become occupation? The Italian experience, 1943-1945. 60 years ago this summer, with a massive amphibious assault on Sicily, Allied forces began the long task of freeing Europe from the clutches of Nazism. To manage their presence in the country, the armies brought with them an elaborate military bureaucracy. First, there was Allied military government, right behind the battle line. AMG's official orders were simply to prevent disease and unrest in the official formula. But it soon found itself faced with bigger challenges. As a Brookings political scientist recalled in 1948, the adjustments of modern society were so delicate and the impact of modern war so comprehensive that an elaborate web of non-military activities had to be organized merely to protect the military advantages gained. Nothing delayed for long the interest of the indigenous population in food, clothing, work, and some sort of social organization. After AMG came the apparatus of so-called civil affairs, which took a longer view and was supposed to restart local government, the law and order system, the shattered economy. But in Italy, the armies were also expected to organize the destruction of fascism and supervise the transition to a post-fascist state. So an Allied control commission was put in place, a stultifying piece of Anglo-American military bureaucracy, which in British eyes was meant additionally to prepare the Italians for a punitive peace treaty and thereby teach them a lesson. Though the Americans wanted the commission run by civilians and did succeed in removing the word control, the British wouldn't shift. It stayed military and the Italians stayed out of it. Up to now, historians have spent little time reflecting on the meaning of those words liberation and occupation in our contemporary conflicts. Since the arrival of total war with its ideologies, every army has claimed to be in the liberation business, and this has drained the word of much of its credibility. But what of occupation? A few years ago, Professor Reynolds of Cambridge looked at the encounter between British society and the 3 million Americans who during World War II passed through the UK on their way to the battles in Europe. The subtitle of his remarkable book was The American Occupation of Britain, and in it we find a rare reflection on the experience of armies when they are not fighting, i.e. most of the time. Boredom, indiscipline and disease are the greatest problems, and sex, alcohol and money the traditional antidotes. Without the discipline of combat, a conscript army is always under risk of breaking down into its component individuals, of becoming a kind of mob. In the armies of democracies, the citizenry emerges. Plunder is no longer allowed as compensation and fraternization always hazardous. In wartime Italy, a complex tension between liberation and occupation grew up. As it's recalled today, the war brought liberation for the North, occupation for the South, liberation for the young, occupation for the old, liberation for women, occupation for men, liberation for the right, occupation for the left. Everyone agrees that the British were the occupiers, the Americans the liberators. Historians can challenge these images, but they can never deny there was one impulse keeping everyone going. The knowledge that the war would end one day, and then all the armies, enemy, ally, partisan, or whatever, would all go away.
You've been listening to David Elwood, Professor of International History at the University of Bologna, and the author of Italy 1943-1945, The Politics of Liberation. To conclude this week's show, we offer you another of Alec Berza's historical hoaxes. This week, he calls in with the Great Monkey Hoax. Berza, a frequent contributor to Talking History, is the author of The Museum of Hoaxes, published by Dutton Press, and the curator of the virtual museum of the same name.
It was a hot night on July 8, 1953, and police officer Shirley Brown and his partner were doing a routine patrol down a rural highway near Austell, Georgia. Up ahead, they saw a pickup truck stopped in the middle of the road and pulled over to investigate. What they found was the most unusual scene they would ever encounter during their entire careers as officers. Three frightened young men were waiting nervously by the side of the road, and lying there on the tarmac in front of the truck, illuminated by the vehicle's headlights, was a bizarre 2-foot-tall creature that looked for all the world like a space alien. The young men spilled out a strange tale. They said they'd been out in their truck, honky-tonking around, when they came over a hill and suddenly found themselves careening towards a flying saucer that was glowing red all over. Three small aliens were outside the craft, wandering up and down the highway. The boys jammed on their brakes, but couldn't avoid hitting one of the aliens. The other two spacemen made it to the ship and blasted off. At first, the officers weren't sure whether to believe the tale, but they couldn't deny the physical evidence that backed it up, the long skid marks on the highway, and the body of the alien itself lying lifeless in the road, a hairless, 2-foot-tall humanoid creature with eerie, round, dark eyes. Hours later, word of the capture of an extraterrestrial had leaked out to the press, and the sleepy Georgia county found itself at the center of a media frenzy. Reporters from Atlanta descended on the small town, and news offices from around the country flooded the switchboard of the police station. Even representatives from the Air Force arrived to assess the situation. A local veterinarian proclaimed that the body did indeed look like something out of this world. But when officials from the Georgia Crime Lab showed up a day later, they soon deduced that the alien was nothing more than a shaved capuchin monkey whose tail had been cut off. When confronted with his expert opinion, the boys quickly confessed. They explained that it had all been nothing more than a prank inspired by a bet made during a card game. One of the boys had wagered his friends that he could get himself featured in the local paper within a week. So to win the bet, he had bought a monkey at a local pet shop, gave it a lethal dose of chloroform, shaved its hair, and chopped off its tail. The result was a creature that looked decidedly alien. The good news for the young man was that he handily won his bet. He was profiled not only in local, but also national papers. The bad news was that the police fined him $40 for obstructing the highway. The boys dropped out of public view after this, but their caper has lived on in Georgia lore, remembered somewhat ambivalently by locals as the Great Monkey Hoax of 1953.
Thank you, Alex, and that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments on this program or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.